Welcome everyone to the sixth episode of the Baptizing Philosophy Podcast. Today I'm here with my good friend Gabriel Sprock of the Gabriel Sprock YouTube channel. And we're going to be talking about René Guénon, his work, and how it overlaps and differs with Christianity, specifically Orthodox Christianity, as both Gabe and I are Orthodox Christians. Gabe isn't baptized yet, but he's aspiring. So, yeah, Gabe, maybe just to begin, you could sort of give an introduction to the work of René Guénon and what you find interesting and of value in his work.
Well, I would say I'm going to answer your second question first because it's easier. Sure. What I find valuable about his work is I really think that he kind of provides certain insights into the state of modernity that not a lot of other, like, I guess you could say reactionary or I'll just say traditionalist philosophers, that they don't really engage in these sort of critiques that he engages in. And it's mostly that his critiques are... they're really like metaphysical critiques that also combine with sociology at the same time. Whereas you'll see like a lot of traditionalist or reactionary philosophers, they'll give critiques of modernity, but they're purely sociological critiques that don't really go into like the deeper metaphysical or what they believe to be the deeper underlying metaphysical reasons for the sort of state of affairs that people find themselves within in the modern context. Mm-hmm.
So you're interested in mostly the philosophical critique of materialism that he provides, right?
Yeah. And so basically, just to kind of sum that up, so for Guénon, he's I need to kind of preface his critique with a couple things here so people kind of understand where he's coming from. Guénon is heavily influenced by Neoplatonism, Plato, Aristotle, in particular Aristotle's hylomorphism. Mm-hmm. Basically, the idea of hylomorphism, for those who aren't familiar, is that substance is the product of form and matter. Now, Guénon actually kind of he switches up the language, so it becomes confusing if you read Aristotle and then read him, because he talks about substance as not matter, but just sort of pure potentiality. And pure potentiality, I put that in quotes because that actually can't exist for him, because you need actuality as well. And so for him, the world is bifurcated into two poles of existence, the essential pole and the substantial pole, which is also known as the pole of being, that's proper to the essential pole, and the pole of becoming, which is proper to the substantial pole. And being imposes itself on becoming, and then that can also be understood as essence imposing itself on substance, or actuality imposing itself on potentiality. Mm-hmm. And through this, you sort of have, the world, the manifestation is what he calls it, because he's heavily influenced by that Platonic language, and also Hindu metaphysics too. Through this sort of imposition of actuality onto potentiality, you create distinction in the world. And now distinction in the world, it can't be reduced down to matter, but even matter itself, even the ontology of matter, being a distinct sort of substance, right? Mm-hmm. Or distinct ontology or object, has its own essence. Mm-hmm. And this essence, right? Well, this just shows that matter itself can't be the fundamental sort of basis of reality, because it presupposes a higher kind of level of existence, which is that of essence.
Just to cut you off real quick, that sort of reminds me of that video I made on distinction and why materialism can't account for distinction, because if what materialism says is that only matter is real, you would have to find something material that is distinction. And it's the same goes for all universals and everything transcendental, immaterial, or what we commonly experience as material. If you cannot find matter that is distinction, then you're just presupposing, you're dogmatically presupposing distinction, which is immaterial, and then claiming that to be materialism. So it's an inconsistent form. I think Guénon is basically saying the exact same thing here.
Yeah, exactly. The actual category of distinction, as a universal category. Like that cannot be reduced down to matter. And even if you try and again, like even if you try and reduce it down to matter, matter itself is a distinct ontology. So it already presupposes the reality of distinction. He actually has in his book, in the first chapter of his book, The Reign of Quantity and the Signs of the Times, he talks about, you know, the ancients didn't actually see, like even the ancient materialists or whatever, they didn't actually see matter in the same way we do, because, you know, we had this idea of matter being in a constant state of motion, but that's actually derived from an older idea of pure potentiality, pure like primordial chaos, which is what he calls substance. So substance kind of epistemologically turned into this notion of matter, I guess, in Renaissance philosophy and Enlightenment philosophy, but it's completely, he says, a totally deformed idea. He actually even rejects, in another book he wrote called, this is actually my favorite book by Guénon, is The Metaphysical Principles of the Infinitesimal Calculus. He talks about, he rejects the notions of atoms, not in like that there can't be smaller units of reality, but he rejects the notion of atoms being indivisible, because for him, what he calls extension, which I guess he kind of takes from Descartes, this extension, or rather something with a surface area or any area, any sort of I guess you could say shape to it, anything that has a geometric nature, logically speaking, it can be reduced and infinitely, or in to use his language, indefinitely.
It's just Zeno's paradox, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he cites that at the end of that book as well. So that's also, he kind of has like this, his metaphysics actually kind of play a lot into like the rest of his social critiques that you can see later on in his book, The Reign of Quantity.
Yeah, so would you say that his understanding so you say that he's like Aristotelian, or takes a lot of influence from Aristotle's hylomorphism, and I think you did a pretty good summary of his critique of materialism sort of on that basis, the fact that even the notion of matter already presupposes the immaterial form of distinction. But what about his take on the ultimate nature of everything, and sort of this, the Platonic, in the Neoplatonic view on how everything ultimately returns to unity, and that at its core, everything is ultimately unified. And it doesn't necessarily mean distinctions aren't real, strictly speaking. I mean, that's at least what the Platonists will say. Whether or not their ontology actually grounds distinction is up for debate, I think. But whether for them, basically, there are different levels of being, and you sort of get, distinction becomes more and more prominent as you move away from the first and the highest level of being, which is the one, which is unity, pure unity, basically. So what's Guénon's take on sort of the view, what's his view on the nature of objects and their ultimate almost like their fate, I guess? Like, is there like a return to unity that is necessary, and is unity the essence of everything, and distinction just the result of like a lower like hypostasis, to use the Neoplatonic language, or is there like real distinction in the world and different things, to use the Christian reinterpretation of the term hypostasis? Individual things are in hypostasize, like the essence is in hypostasize, things are distinct, and are not, their distinction is not just a lower level of being, but is actually innate and will be preserved even into the eschaton, even when everything returns back to the one, who is God. They will be preserved in their distinction, because distinction for us is a category that exists at the highest level, because distinction exists in the triune God for us. So what's Guénon's take on this, on unity and distinction?
Yeah, so in The Reign of Quantity and the Signs of the Times, he actually has a chapter on unification. He makes a distinction between unification and what he calls uniformity. And What distinguishes them is that one is of a qualitative nature and one is of a quantitative nature. I should probably qualify that too here, because that's also a big like metaphysical sort of bifurcation or dualism in his philosophies. You know, he believes that there's a qualitative realm, which is the realm of essence, and there's a quantitative realm, which is the realm of substance. But yeah, for going on this, he believes that he's very influenced also by the Neoplatonic tradition, and that he believes that everything, multiplicity, is all a sort of falling away from the one. And he actually equates multiplicity with, I guess, in a sense, in a lower form of being.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks it is a lower form of being. And then, yes, I would agree that like a sort of traditional Neoplatonist, things do subsume back into the one. This is very much how, like, I assume he'd probably agree a lot with like Origen's reading of Christianity or something.
Yeah.
But when just speaking on that idea of unity and, or rather unification and uniformity, he distinguishes between two types of these. One is of a qualitative nature, one is of a quantitative nature. So I'm going to talk about the quantitative nature, which is uniformity, where basically in modernity you have a kind of false notion of unification, where we unify things not by their essences, but simply by their by the fact we can just kind of reduce them down to single, well, for lack of a better term, units or digits. And this is just kind of seen in the way we systematize the world, but we don't realize, like, we do this, but we don't actually think of like a higher sense of unity, which is a sort of like unity of all distinct ontologies, like you just mentioned, that are all part of this one universal sort of being.
Mm-hmm.
So for Guinan, yeah, he does put a primacy on unity, and like this is also reflected in his like perennialism. It presupposes this sort of metaphysical state of affairs.
Right. Well, yeah, on that topic, what is his take on religions and and the various religions, and specifically Christianity? Like, does he have a specific take on Christ and the incarnation and the Trinity? Because, and also, I guess my question would also be like, he's a perennialist, but like, what about the various religions would he see as the higher truth that they express? Like, what is their principle of unity? Because if he's seeing as their principle of unity sort of this Platonic view, because when I was talking with Erval, it seems like Erval basically takes that view that Christianity is just one particular understanding of this perennialist philosophy, where that is expressed in Plato, and it has to do with everything being there being different levels of being, ultimately everything returns to the one, and everything descends from the one, and everything that descends from the one has a lower level of being. So what's is Guénon's view that ultimately it is this notion of a fundamental unifying principle of reality that everything returns to and everything fundamentally is that what he sees as the core of the perennialist truth, I would say, or is it something else? And how does he understand, like, does he have a specific reading of something like the incarnation of Christ and the Trinity? Because fact of the matter is, once you really understand these doctrines and realize the radical nature of what they are putting forth, like the metaphysics, the ontology, the view of reality, which I would, if I had to put a term on it, and it's the term we've been using recently, is communion. It's this understanding of one is not strictly speaking one, like, and that's how we don't fall into this trap of thinking everything is like a unity. One is actually three. God is three. So there's multiplicity in the very notion of unity. And unity consists of a full mutual indwelling, a mutual interiority of multiple elements to form one thing, not to the detriment of distinction. As we always say in Orthodox theology, distinction does not entail division. So what's Guénon's take on one, the unifying element or principle of the various world religions, and what's his take? How does he account for doctrines which are so radical and so novel, such as the incarnation of Christ and the Trinity?
So I think, because Guénon does put this primacy on oneness, I think he would say that, Like, I think he'd have a reading of Christianity, like I was saying before, that's similar to Origen. And obviously, I would disagree with him there. I would also, like, I think he kind of sees, like, throughout all of these, all the world religions, like, just a sort of, like, return to the one. Like, in Hinduism, there's a lot of different schools of thought. Some of them are much more monistic than others. And I think he would see, and I actually, I mean, I don't know too much about his view on Hinduism, but I do believe that in Hindu philosophy, there is a belief, a pretty popular belief, that all these gods are actually just a reflection of, like, the one higher god, which is Brahman or something.
Brahman.
Like, I have to. And he actually, I believe, like, a large part of his conversion to Islam was because of the doctrine of the Tawhid, whatever, and of, you know, this sort of, like, unity and oneness of God. So I think he was a little over focused on that aspect, and I think his primordial basically his perennialism, which I think was much more explicated by a later thinker, or actually not that much of a later thinker, but a thinker that was around at the same time, if it's Schuon, I think he has this idea that all the world religions are a reflection of the one universal sort of, like, Platonic truth. But these different world religions focus on certain aspects of the one universal truth that the others don't.
Right.
So, for example, he would say that Christianity focuses more on, like, the personable aspects of the divine, whereas something like Hinduism focuses more on the kind of impersonal and abstract aspects of the divine, and something like Islam focuses more on, like, the unity of the divine. Now, I would take issue with that because, like, all of these systems have completely different, like, metaphysical understandings of what the divine is. So it doesn't, like, in order for different traditions to focus on the same thing, they would have to, I think, agree on what that thing is, and they don't. So that's where I think he kind of falls short. But now you asked about the incarnation, and I'm not so sure. I know he did have some books on Christian mysticism that I haven't looked into. But he does have a weird view on Adam and Genesis. And I mean, that is involved in Christianity. His view of this is basically that, and I think this comes from his understanding of the Jewish mysticism of the Kabbalah and all this. He says that Adam, like, bifurcated into, like, multiple different atoms. And he gets really schizo at some points. He relates this, like, he says, like, Adam was in, like, what Plato called Atlantis, and, like, this tradition came down from the polar north and then spread into Atlantis and created this red race, which Adam was a part of. So, I don't know, you know, how he comes to these conclusions. But he's got, like, definitely a wacky understanding of, like, Genesis and all that.
Well,
In terms of the incarnation, I don't know exactly what he said, but I do think maybe Schuon said this, or it might have been him. I'm pretty sure I heard somewhere that, and I've heard it in other perennialist circles too, that, like, they would just believe that, like, Christ is a representative of a bunch of other figures, of divine figures that incarnated, and, like, there's really nothing special about him.
He's basically an avatar.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I think it's probably similar to Erival's view, maybe. But
yeah, and it's kind of silly because, I don't know if you know of C.S. Lewis's trilemma on the identity of Christ, where if you accept that Christ, if presupposing that the Gospels are at least a overall general reliable record of the teachings and the preaching and life of Christ, you can either say that Christ was a liar, a lunatic, or the Lord, because he said to be God. Like, avatar straight up said to be God, but Jesus said that before Abraham was, I am. He clearly identified, like, the Gospel of John even more, like, and I was just reading the Gospel of Mark, and I remember, like, watching Seraphim Hamilton's debate with Shabir Ali, and he was talking about how there's a discontinuity between the earlier Gospels and the Gospel of John on the divine identity of Christ. But I'm reading the Gospel of Mark, and I'm like, how can you, obviously, when you're reading about Christ's preaching, it's not like it wasn't as Because it was like Christ himself says, it's like there's a proper time for the full revelation, right? But even still, reading the Gospel of Mark, like I couldn't come to the conclusion that he wasn't God, like just the language he was using, stuff he was described as doing. If you understand the Old Testament and the references made that are made and the typology there, it's pretty clear. So the point of that is just to say that the notion that Christ is just some divine teacher is equivalent to the person C.S. Lewis was describing, like the modern person who's like, yeah, well, I don't think he's God, but he was a good moral teacher. And it's like, well, no, a good moral teacher doesn't claim to literally be God. That's either a liar, a lunatic, or actually God himself, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, well, the whole idea of like, when Christ said, my kingdom is not of this world, I mean, like, if you have to...
Yeah.
Like, what else can you conclude from that? Because if someone has a kingdom, well, that implies they are a king, first of all. And if you are a king of another world, and it's not of this one, and it's of, you know, or heaven, basically is what he's saying. Well, then if you're king of heaven, I mean, what else can you be but God?
And it's funny because the God of heaven is, that actually sort of like relates to perennialism a bit. There's this in anthropologists have this idea of the sky god phenomenon, and in Native America, South America, China, ancient Chinese cultures, Australia, the Middle East, there's this phenomenon of there being, yeah, multiple gods, like there's a pantheon of gods, but if you look to the oldest traditions, there's this highest god, and they call it the sky god phenomenon, because almost everywhere you go, there's this idea that this god exists in the sky, in some sense, is the above everything else, right? So the Chinese have this term, the Emperor of Heaven. The Native Americans have a similar term, by identifying Christ with the King of Heaven, that's identifying him with the Old Testament God. Now, just to kind of move back to something you said about Adam, because I found that interesting. I was wondering if you knew a little more about it, if you knew the details about Guignol's take on this, because it seems to me, with the way you were describing it, that and it's a pattern in these type of non-Trinitarian thinkers to identify multiplicity with evil or with sin or with the fall, because it kind of seems like he's identifying the fall of Adam with this fracturing into more atoms. That's to me contrary to Genesis. Not only is it contrary to our theology, because multiplication is not evil, but it's contrary to Genesis itself, because in Genesis 1, God tells Adam to be fruitful and multiply. So it's not even coherent based on the narrative of the text itself. But that's the way Guignol reads it. It's like the multiplicity goes hand in hand with the fall. It's a result of the fall.
Yeah, I would say that, because he talks about like the shattering of Adam and all these kinds of things. And I think it would like have to follow from the prior metaphysics that I laid out before, when he talks about how like multiplicity is a fall away from unity. And for him, unity is obviously the highest state of being,
right?
Or the most supreme state of being. So any form of multiplicity is a aberration or derivation away from the primordial one, which is like the highest sort of, or the most supreme state of existence for him. And he actually laid out a symbol in his book on that chapter on unification of a triangle. And at the apex of the triangle is supposed to be the pole of unity. And towards the end of the triangle, towards the base of the triangle, rather, you have lines going down. And these lines going down represent like the indefinite sort of decrease into quantity, away from quality. So, yeah, and obviously the reign of quantity for him is associated with evil, because that's the cycle of the Kali Yuga,
right?
Which is evil. But in a weird way, he actually says that even though this Kali Yuga, this sort of a period, and he gets this from Hindu theology, even though this is like an evil period when it's understood on its own, it's actually really a good thing, because that cycle, it's proper to a cycle itself that is overall a divine cycle. So I guess in a weird way, like for him, good and evil become sort of on the same level. And which I think is almost Gnostic, in a way.
Yeah,
and he was actually at some point in his life, he was part of a Gnostic cult, so it makes sense he would kind of believe that.
It's kind of it that idea kind of requires this sort of Gnostic detachment from the world in order to say something like, to look at the evils that go on in this world and say that, oh no, actually, when you take a wider perspective, it's actually good in the end. It's like everything needs to blend into this one unifying thing so that there can't be room for like negativity. There can't be room for evil. It all has to be in some sense a part of it. I think this is like something Hegel falls into too, especially. Yeah, but like in Christianity, God, like God cares about every single little thing that happens. Like God is personally involved. It matters to him. He cares. He has a deep love for everyone. So Staniloy in his book, not his book, his essay. I'm pretty sure you read the essay Eternity and Time.
Yeah.
Which everyone, in order to be communal ontology pilled, you need to read Eternity and Time. I want to talk about time. So that's actually a good thing to talk about. In Eternity and Time, he talks about how he ends it by saying that eternity weeps for man in time. So Christianity has the ability to conceive of a God, a personal God who can enter into time and actually care about the mundane things, the small things, our petty squabbles, our the evil in the world. And evil is not something substantial, but it matters. It does exist. It is something that is occurring. It's not just an illusion. It is something that God himself will weep over. It's not something that from God's perspective, it's, oh, actually, no, it's good. No, that is to reject the true freedom of a creature, the freedom of a creature to actually be other than God and to rebel against God and to rebel against the infinite, the eternal. That is what creation is. And I think that, well, maybe before we talk about time, does Guénon have a particular take on creation? Like, how does he view creation? Is it just like the common Neoplatonic view where creation is sort of like almost like the lowest form, like material creation is like the lowest form of the different manifestation, or however you want to put it, the different.
It would be the lowest form because it has all this multiplicity and it is like a unification of essence and substance,
right?
And for and obviously he's gonna privilege the
essence and substance. That's the terms he used.
Yeah, well, he uses multiple terms. So the essential pole and substantial pole. Okay. The substantial pole is the same as the quantitative.
Yeah.
And the essential pole is the same as the qualitative, and also essence, quality, and being are the same, and becoming is part of substance and quantity. So those three, or those six, are the terms he uses, and he would see it as the lowest form of creation or existence. Rather, he actually calls it, I believe he's like an emanationist in this sense.
And
like, so for him, there is almost no, like, I don't think he would agree with like the essence energy distinction. He wouldn't. I don't think he would like find it as a valid sort of thing. Obviously, we disagree with that. And I think, well, yeah, I guess he would say it is the lowest form of manifestation also because it is subject to this kind of like change in cycles, right. But there are higher cycles as well and all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So with the cycles, like this is an ancient view, right? Like the idea that everything is sort of in this cyclic, motion, and you go through different stages. Obviously, it's very much in Hinduism, but it's also in antiquity, in classical antiquity with the Greeks and the Greek philosophers, like Heraclitus believed this, and I think the Stoics believed this, that everything ultimately is just in a cycle. And I think Christianity, is it sort of breaks the cycle here. Because Christ is this concrete moment where eternity truly enters into time and is able to give time infinite eternal value, right? So everything is brought. This is what it means to for God to for the New Jerusalem to arise through the union of heaven and earth. It's because eternity, heaven and earth are different. There are different terms you can use for it. It's eternity and time as well, right?
So right.
because Earth was created into time. In Genesis 1, God creates the heavens and the earth, and the earth is formless and void. The earth is meant to be cultivated, to grow, to mature, and that growth and mature is time. That interval of its maturity and the way it matures, like the way we understand teleology in Orthodox Christianity, is a upwards ascent towards God and towards the logi of everything. Like, these are the inner principles of everything, which are ultimately unified in the logos in Christ. So everything is directed towards Christ, and Christ enters into us as we enter into him, and then there's this union of eternity and time. So time isn't opposed to eternity, but for these thinkers, there can't be this upward ascent. There can't be anything genuinely new there. And similarly, there can't be, it doesn't seem like there can be the possibility of truly becoming lost. Like, there isn't the potential of true heaven, nor is there potentiality of true hell, simply because there's no way to escape this cycle of time. There is no true freedom. There is no true creative capacity for something genuinely new. And that would be right. My critique of this whole cyclic view of time. But maybe you could just, we've already gotten to the critique, but I think that applies in general to cyclic time and this notion of the reoccurrence of the eternal return of things. But what's Guénon's particular understanding of cyclic time in like the different ages of the world and stuff like that?
Right. So I can actually talk about this. You might find this interesting. He has a very specific theory of time and like how this, the change in cycles will actually look like. Well, he kind of, I think roughly speaking, he kind of, like, his sort of theory of time is it's heavily derived from the Hesiod's sort of, okay, you know, golden age, bronze age, all these different ages. The golden age obviously being the highest, and then the ages away from that being, you know, slower derivations away from the highest age. And then, you know, he going on says, well, you know, the movement here is also kind of illusory, because you're not actually moving in any new direction. You're just kind of going to the same spot over and over. And, you know, the end in one direction is actually just the beginning in the other direction. Mm-hmm. And there is no end, because there is no beginning, because it's eternal. Now, his whole idea, and we would be very opposed to this. And I remember reading this a long time ago, and I thought it was a very fascinating idea. So just to preface this, Guénon was, you know, he studied mathematics. He was also really into physics. And during this time, he, I believe in the 40s, you know, physics was really taking off with the sort of theories of dimensions and all this. He speaks about, and I have a post on this, about time turning into space. Time turning into space. And this is basically the same notion of the end of the world going back, the end of the Kali Yuga going back into the golden age, or what he would call like the New Jerusalem or heaven, which he has a misunderstanding of.
Yeah.
But basically this idea is, so time and space are obviously unified. This is like the whole notion of space time. Mm-hmm. Like, there is no, for the physicist, right, there is no movement or change without the existence of objects, and objects exist in space. And for going on, as this age sort of closes in on itself, what's going to happen is space will speed up, or rather time will speed up. And as time speeds up, space shrinks, because once distance becomes smaller and smaller, the time itself will be quicker, because the distance between two objects is smaller. And that means the time becomes smaller as well. Mm-hmm. And then eventually this time sort of compresses space to a point, to like an infinitely small point, and then we kind of have a creation back into the golden age, where there is no time. It is just like eternal stasis, because with time and with change, you have this the same process of what will basically change leads to just more distinction and more of becoming as opposed to being. So there again, we see this sort of Platonic influence once again in his metaphysical sort of landscape.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's interesting, because the way we understand this acceleration of time, like, we don't, there's a sense in which time is accelerated for us, in the sense that as we approach union with God, we are we are entering into eternity. We are reaching our destination, right? So it's like an upwards ascent, but it's not like a, it's not just like pure velocity, right? Like that's not the way we're understanding it. But so I do think he has a point there in terms of the way, like Heidegger even talks about this, like the abolition of distance, right? Like what trains were doing back then. It's what like they couldn't even imagine something like iPhones and what even what we're doing right now. We are literally in different countries, and we're talking directly to each other as if it were a conversation, So like, yeah, but like for us, the when it comes to the I guess I would have a problem kind of with this understanding of the abolition of space and time, because could you sort of maybe repeat? I'm struggling to remember exactly how you framed it, how it works, like how they negate each other.
Yeah. So, okay. I'm just going to, the best way to explain it is when you have more space, and let's just make it really simple. When you have a larger distance between point A and point B,
right,
you have the possibility for more time.
Yes,
is there because the distance between point A and point B is greater. But when that distance becomes so close, there's less time to exist because the distance between the two objects is smaller. And as this distance sort of closes in on itself, this is the sort of ending of the cycle, and that just gets faster and faster as it gets to as A and B sort of approach one another, and then they collide, and then they create, he says time takes over space, and then paradoxically space comes back out of time, and then it just exists in this sort of like there's no movement whatsoever in this sort of golden age. And then the problem with that to me though is like, okay, how do we move then from the golden age to the other ages if there's no movement at all?
Yeah, that's kind of like Origen's problem, like for Origen. And I know there are people who dispute the extent to which he believed this and the specific details, but at least the way it was interpreted by the church and the view that was condemned under the title of Origenism is the idea that you have these souls that almost become like bored in heaven. And this would be, I guess, equivalent to the golden age. And then being bored in this state of bliss, they fall. And it's like kind of seems arbitrary. It doesn't really make sense. And I think, probably Guénon probably falls into the same issue here.
Yeah, exactly. I just like if you don't have any movement, right, then
this is actually
like how can
This is perfect, like to really get into the Christian critique of this in the view that Steniloy presents of eternity and time, because for us eternity is not a ceasing of motion, like Saint Maximus the Confessor calls the eschaton the ever moving rest. Now that's an antinomy for our logic, but it makes sense once you actually work through it the way Steniloy does in that essay and elsewhere. He talks about how as things converge towards each other, as the lover and the loved are converging towards each other, as God and creation are brought together, this is not a destruction of space in the sense of a destruction of the substantial reality of the fullness of life, right? It's not like we're collapsing it to a pure point of nothingness, like this point of time, which is hell, like it's just this pure solitary point. And like Dugin even talks about this, like how in the Fourth Political Theory, he has a quote where he talks about like this, the way in which time can compress to the sliver and how it relates to the subject that's completely divided from the other and out of communion. But anyways, getting off track, the way we understand it is there is this union of things, and that union is the fullest manifestation of time, because time is never just a series of events. It's always like a directional motion. Everything is teleological, and this is what Christ reveals that everything is being, everything was directed towards him, and now everything is his revelation is being actualized, manifested in creation as he is harvesting the fruit. He is harvesting creation and bringing it back towards him and unifying it into him. And so eternity is not the negation of time in like this point of stasis. Eternity is the fullest manifestation of time, to the point where time has been fully completed, as it is this motion of the lover and the beloved, and there is no more distance there. So there's not that space of nothingness. There's not the incompletion separating us, and we can't really grasp it. But as the fathers, like the Cappadocians and Saint Maximus, describe it, specifically Maximus and Gregory of Nyssa, the eschaton as eternity is not a negation of motion. It's the full actualization of motion, insofar as motion is life. Motion is this, like, we are moving, we are acting, and this acting is our life. It's what we are. It's how we exist. It's our mode of being. So our mode of being will be fully actualized in eternity. And that's that understanding of time, I don't think we find in Guénon. It's sort of like he can't think the communal logic.
Well, yeah, the thing is, the way he's describing time and as a consequence, what he thinks heaven is actually, I think, what we would call hell. Because
what
you end up going into is just this paralyzed state.
Exactly.
And there's nothing, you know, there's nothing nice about being paralyzed at all. No. So the interesting thing also is, I think because he has two, like, paradoxically, for someone who's a very esoteric thinker, his understanding of time is very physical. Mm-hmm. In that, like, when I was coming up for, like, when I was writing this book a while ago, I wrote a chapter on time, and I kind of realized I accidentally made an argument for the existence of God through arguing why time, the time we experience, can't be eternal, because you would have like this infinite sort of regress in time, and you'd never be able to have one point in time, because there would be infinite sort of an infinite series of points in between any point, and you can never move. And she would need something to sort of limit time in order for it to work. And obviously what is outside of time is what is eternal. And then I obviously would think from that, it would have to be God, because it can't just be some other like state of like space or being, cause that doesn't make sense either. But obviously within God, he's able to sort of like, he's not sort of limited by like, if God can act and move, right, he sort of has the ability not to change in himself, but to change in what he can do.
Yeah.
So he's not.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was talking about this with this Jewish guy in the server, Pathfinder, and he was talking about how God is everything. So everything that is God. And I'm like, that's fallacious. Like if you read like someone like Dionysius, God is everything precisely because he created everything. God has the power to give what is his to another in a way that does not negate himself. And the only way you can have this is if you have an essence energy distinction. And that is simply a distinction between what God is in himself. So the Holy Trinity is complete in itself, so that he can create, and creation is an act. It is an act of God, an energy of God. Now creation isn't an eternal energy, because he's not always eternally creating, but anyways, and that's part of the freedom of God, right? He has the ability, because creation is so contingent. It is so unnecessary for God. Like on an ontological level, it would do nothing to God if all of us were destroyed right now, or if we all went to hell. And that doesn't mean God doesn't care for us. He wants us all to be saved. That's his will. But will is separate from essence. Like contra St. Thomas Aquinas, or what most, the interpretation of Thomas that many people give, there isn't an identity, like a strict identity between will and essence, nor is there a strict identity between energy, will, and essence. God can truly posit something, create something out of nothing that is not him, but he is it, because he is giving something to creation that is properly his, which is being. But being isn't, strictly speaking, him. So his essence is not being, because if his essence were being and then he gave being to something outside of himself, he would be dependent on that, because his essence would be bound up with creation. So you enter into all these different problems of evil and or the problem of evil and all these different logical problems when you say that God is, strictly speaking, creation. And even like the Neoplatonists try and kind of get out of it by saying that, oh, but there are different levels of being and distinction. But like ultimately, like I don't even know it kind of seems arbitrary, and it's kind of hard to, I don't really have like a full-blown argument, like philosophical argument showing why you can't just say, oh, well, yeah, distinction is real, like as Arval says. And not to be like, I'm not trying to be condescending to Arval. He's a brilliant guy, way more well-read than me. But the way he frames it is, distinction is real, but it's a less form, it's a lesser form of reality. And like, ultimately, all distinctions will be, if they return to what they truly are, and they lose this state of lesser being, they will attain to the one, and it's a one without distinction, and it a one which is the essence of God. It is the one, what is. I don't even know what we're talking about.
Yeah, he's because when I interviewed him, he did say something similar. And I think it can really just be summed up as like the distinctions in reality are contingent upon the unity in reality. Mm-hmm. And I don't have a problem with that, but I would say like, but the unity itself is also in a way contingent upon the multiplicity, because the unity has to be a unification of something.
Exactly.
I actually think Hegel makes this point when he talks about universality, individuality, and particularity. Like, mm-hmm. universality has to, in order for it to be universality, it needs to be a universalizing of something,
right?
And that's where the individual comes into place. So that's why Hegel makes a sort of dialectical shift in understanding of this. And then for the individual, like, it needs the particular in order for mm-hmm. it to be individual, because individual is almost like the in a weird paradoxical sense, individual is a universal category of particular. It is mm-hmm. our universal way of understanding particulars. Yes. And then you have universality, which is like a higher level of understanding individuality and all these kinds of things.
Well, what would be Guénon's take on this? Because you mentioned that in your video, your fantastic hour, longer than an hour long video covering the reign of quantity, you talk about how for Guénon, so you need a particular in order to know substance. And it confused me for a bit, because we in Christianity, we kind of use the term substance, nature, and essence interchangeably, while for him, substance and essence are the two, that's the dualism there. So they're opposite. But his take is that, so I'm just going to frame our take on the necessity of the particular to know substance, because as you were saying, Guénon says that you need a particular in order to know substance. So you need a quantity. No, you need a particular determinate form of quantity in order to know quantity. You can't just have pure quantity. For us, it's that even essence itself, like human nature, is not, there is no ideal Platonic form, which is human nature. There isn't even a divine essence, which is just the divine essence separated from the divine persons. No, the divine persons are the hypostasis of the essence, and essence only ever exists in the form of hypostasis. Not that it is hypostasis, but it is enhypostasized. That's the patristic term.
Right.
We talked about how human nature is enhypostasized in the particular human being, so that human nature only ever exists as distinct from the person, but in the person. So what's Guénon's take on that? Does he only apply that to quantity? And then for essence does exist in this ideal realm of forms, or not even realm of forms, just like this ideal realm that doesn't have to have particularity. What's his take on that?
So I think, yes, like you kind of mentioned the idea of like, in order to have knowledge, you'd have to, well, this is Guénon's idea, in order to have knowledge, you'd have to have this sort of essential determination upon substance and distinction. And obviously, like, at a very basic level, there always is distinction with knowledge, because there is always a distinction between what is being known and who is knowing, at the very least. And once you know something, you also know what it is not as well. Mm-hmm. So knowledge presupposes a bunch of other forms of knowledge, too. Guénon, like, as I mentioned before, he has this like Aristotelian sort of hylomorphism going on, where he would, and we're going to talk about like the world of forms here in a minute, like where he would differ from Aristotle is that I think Aristotle immanentizes the world of forms, in that like they don't exist in an ideal world, they exist in the same plane of being, but they're just like, we know the universal in its instantiation in the particular. But this universal doesn't necessarily exist in a sort of like domain outside of its it exists outside of its instantiation, but it doesn't exist in like its own sort of dimension. It's intrinsically linked to the dimension that it instantiates with. But for Guinan, I think he would say, because he divides it into this sort of pole of essence and substance, I think that would all, and being and becoming, he would divide it into the sort of Platonic world of forms as well. And I think because he is a monist, all of these forms would just collapse into being the same thing, which I think also creates an issue, because if they're all the same thing, then how can we have distinctions in substance then?
Right.
If these forms are the same, like what is the factor that allows for this distinction in substance, which, by the way, substance itself, or pure potentiality, has no distinctions because it requires essence for distinction. Mm-hmm. So if it's not derived from essence, it is not derived from substance, where is it being derived from?
Gotcha. Yeah. So I think we've basically done a good summary of Guinan's take on metaphysics and essentially his Neoplatonism, I would say. Like, would you agree that he's basically working within that framework?
I would say he's definitely a Neoplatonism with a lot of Aristotelian sort of characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say he's definitely like those two thinkers are definitely make the crux of his metaphysics. And right. I think this is also why he's ended up really being attracted to Islam, because Islam utilizes a lot of Aristotle and a lot of Neoplatonism as well. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense why he would kind of pick that religion in the end.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I was going to say it kind of seems like the Islamic view on stuff like divine simplicity and the metaphysical understanding they have, that's especially Aristotelian for them, would fit well with him. But just to transition from his metaphysics, the last thing I want to talk about is sort of his view of modernity and what happened to get to modernity. Specifically, I want to talk about the Protestant Reformation and his critique of the Protestant Reformation, because I also have a critique of the Reformation, which I think is quite patristically informed. Like, I take some of the insights from Gregory Palamas, where he talks about how the Roman Catholic, or the theology that tended to be adopted by the Roman Catholic West post-schism of defining God, or seeing God as this absolute divine simplicity, where there can be no distinction between God's activity and his essence, so what he is and what he does. Since they preclude such a distinction, Palamas will say that this ultimately leads to an inability to know the divine at all, and it leads to a form of atheism. And our view of the cosmos, our view of reality, our view of creation, is it's penetrated by these divine energies, by the presence of God himself, who is forming a real ontological union with us. But once you don't have a notion of the energies, like, that's not to say immediately you completely lose the notion of God's interaction with creation. Like, I would just say Thomas Aquinas was sort of inconsistent when it came to certain views of his. Like, I don't think fundamentally his metaphysics can justify the biblical picture he tries to present of God's interaction and presence in the world. But in any case, like, my critique of the Protestant Reformation is that you're sort of seeing the fruition of this Roman Catholic theology of rejecting the notion that God is truly present in his energies and therefore able to deify creation. And what you get is the Protestant view where, well, no, all you need to know God is you have to have faith in God. And then there's man on this side and then God here. And there's like the separation. There's no longer this man becoming God, which is the image that St. Athanasius presents us with when talking about deification, talking about the purpose of Christ's incarnation. So the Reformation caused this split between man and God where, no, God is not present in the sacraments. There is nothing divine. There is nothing holy about these particular images. No, God right. was not present in these saints. You can't pray for their intercession. And then you have the soul, as you're like, man is like on one side. It's like a very strict divide between man and God, where you have man and he's just absolutely depraved. And there's no internal transformation to justify him. It's just purely forensic, a legal thing. God declares you righteous. monergism, like salvation isn't the synergy, it's just God alone acting. So that's the way I see Protestantism. I seem to remember you talking about Guénon's critique of Protestantism, and it sort of has this similar idea, I think, but I'm sure there's some distinctions as well, but I'll let you sort of present his ideas on that.
Okay. And I think you also wanted me to You asked something about his critique of like modernity, right, as well?
Yeah, just in general, but particularly yes. I'm interested in the Protestant stuff, but also, yeah, in general. Okay. But I know we could do a whole other conversation on his critiques of modernity. Yeah. But.
Well, I can give a very basic summary. I could segue into that.
Sure.
I can do that. Okay, yeah, so cool. In order to understand his critique of modernity and like the modern outlook, you need to understand really two things. The first is the reign of quantity. And then you need to understand what he calls the process of solidification. And he uses a bunch of symbols to describe solidification. He talks about like turning from sphere to cube, which basically is just saying that like you have this sort of, it's the turn of the essential pole to the substantial pole, quality turned into quantity, and all these kinds of things. Basically, the idea with the reign of quantity is that the world has privileged the ontology of quantity more so than the ontology of quality, in that they you know, in a proper sense, you would view quality on top of quantity, as quantity as metaphysically subordinate. But in the modern sort of outlook, that's actually reversed, where quantity actually not even you could even say quantity is prior to quality. It's just there only is quantity for the modern outlook. And through this, you get this process of solidification. This is manifested in multiple ways, sociologically, in the sense that like the economy becomes more like systematized and more purely focused on like material cause and effect and output. And like the for example, like the output of products is more important than the quality of the products. Is just like a sort of side effect of this worldview.
Yeah.
But on a more like anthropological sort of scale, what happens is he has this process. He has this description of the Great Wall, and it's and this is like an analogy that when we start to view the world as absent of the divine, or very distant from the divine, or completely like not like the divine doesn't even exist. Mm-hmm. We put up a barrier, like this sort of like phenomenological barrier,
right,
between our soul and the divine. And in a way, we almost like we don't create atheism, because you can't do that. But we create the illusion of atheism for ourselves, and that, mm-hmm, like we say, mm-hmm, God does not exist, close ourselves off from God.
Right.
And in our closing ourselves off from God, it's almost as if God does not exist, because we've stunted our ability to communicate with him.
Well, I love that idea. Just to quickly interrupt, it's like, I think that's a very Christian idea. Because for us, like, these are all subjective realities when it comes to the fall was a fall away from the objectivity of Eden, of a union with God, into like this subjectivity. And then salvation involves entering back into objectivity, seeing reality as it truly is, knowing God on a personal level. So I think, yeah, like for us, like what he's all talking about, I think that is part of it. But for us, fundamentally, the issue is sin, and sin manifests in different forms. I think there's sin everywhere in the modern world, like in terms of like the way we our consumerism, et cetera, all these ways of seeing reality based in quantity. So yeah, I think that's like a very Christian idea, that like ultimately what we're doing is we're, through our activities, through our sin, we are creating a barrier between God and man, and entering into this more of a self-relating mode of existence, a mode of existence that is barred from communion with God, that's trapped in our own subjectivity.
Right. And then what we have, so now we have this sort of like ontology of the Great Wall that he's, mm-hmm, spoken about. And then he talks about this idea of the fissures in the wall, and the fissures in the wall, he says, okay, so he uses a lot of symbolism in the way he kind of lays this out. At the top of the wall, it is closed off, and so God cannot enter, because we do not allow him to enter. However, there is fissures in the bottom of this wall, and those fissures come from below, not above, and that is where we see like demonic influence take place. And then what happens with demonic influence is that we have a shift away from quantity towards quality, but a sort of deformed version of quality, where we get what he calls counter traditions. So we move from the anti-tradition, which is the reign of quantity, to the counter tradition, which is a sort of like malformed version of a qualitative worldview. And then you get things like man-oriented religions, man-oriented traditions, and Protestantism is a manifestation of this,
right?
Where it's like it demonstrates itself as a kind of tradition and a religion, but it's really a false one. It's one that is centered on man and not really centered on God, and is centered on a false notion of God. So for Guénon, he would quite literally equate, and he speaks at the end of his book that this sort of reign of quantity ends with a malformed version of quality, where we see an antichrist figure. And I think, like, you know, he would equate, and I think he did equate in his book, in The Crisis of the Modern World, he did equate Protestantism with this sort of false tradition, and it is like an antichrist kind of aberration of Christianity. It is like you could quite literally say Protestantism is an anti-Christian form of Christianity that's making itself or propping itself up as a false sort of tradition. And that's his view on that.
What does he view specifically with Protestantism in terms of, like, does he say anything specifically on, like, a separation between God and the world or anything like that, like the points I was making? I'm just wondering because I seem to remember, I may be remembering falsely, I just seem to remember you mentioning something like that.
Yeah, well, from what I remember, and it's been a long time since I've read that section in that book, it's been like 3 years, mm-hmm. but from what I remember, I do think he did speak about how you kind of have, like, first of all, you have a turn away from tradition in, like, an apostolic sense, obviously, and in a liturgical sense. So that's a big chunk of his critique.
Right.
And
right.
I do think he says, like, this is just sort of a it's like a manifestation of it's almost, for him, Luciferian, I guess you could say, because it is a turn toward man, away from God.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just like, oh, here's atheism. It's more like, no, I am supreme. I am God.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in that sense, that's what makes it Luciferian.
Right. Right. Well, I think from my understanding, like, I kind of see it as a dialectic, and you probably remember, like, back in the day, I was talking about writing a book on the death of God, and I still am, but
yes.
I've kind of put it off. But I wanted to trace the history, and there are different moments in the dialectic. Like, there is a point where it seems, and actually Jay Dyer is really good on this point, where it's like it seems like it's far from the opposite view that it takes, but it's like part of the same dialectic, like it's two sides of the same coin, and like orthodoxy transcends the dialectic. So with in this case, like, you have like the separation where you have like this Luciferian thing where it's like carrying, it's all about man. And it's like, I can see a Protestant being like, well, that's completely uncharitable and just false. You know, like, we're the ones saying, well, it's all God alone, right? It has nothing to do with man salvation. Like, well, how are we focusing on man? But I think this is part of the dialectic, right? Like, it's moving away from the incarnational view where God became man and where man becomes God, where there's this union of God and man, where we literally become deified. And then we have this separation of God and man. And like, Protestantism is this one pole that, through the dialectical movement of this idea, ends in true Luciferianism of the Enlightenment, where it does become all about man. But in order to have that man alone philosophy, you already have to have the division between God and man, where you have, which you get in Protestantism. So you get that division into man, sinful, depraved man, and then God alone. And then it's not as far as you may think to go from God alone to man alone. And that's what we saw in the history of.
Right. And this is very interesting because it is sort of like, it's not just like the Protestants are outright saying, oh, no, you know, it's man,
exactly,
and not God.
Exactly.
It's that their logic leads to that,
right,
eventually.
Right.
And you can see this in the actual act of the Reformation and, you know, the nailing of the treatises to the church or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this also, like, this has a political reality to it as well, because and I did a video on this book called On Power by Bertrand de Jouvenel, and he makes the point, and actually so does Carl Schmitt, another political theorist, that you had in like Christian feudal society, you had like the religious law, but then what happened was that it was hard to apply this law to circumstantial kind of events, because when you have like these sort of absolute laws, it's like, okay, well, how do we deal with like a very specific sort of circumstance, like that our sort of code of, you know, laws that are kind of vague or whatever, that they can't really account for what to do here. So then these laws kind of get undermined, these values get undermined first before God does, and then God gets undermined after. And that's where I think you even pointed it out in your book, I think, talking about Don Quixote and how before the fall of or the death of God actually became it was actually the death of the values first.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Because,
that's what
and
Nietzsche
I think that makes sense because that's what Nietzsche is, because that makes more sense because that's more immediate to us.
Mm-hmm, you know, exactly.
We come into contact. And when I say immediate, obviously God is more immediate in an ontological sense, but I mean immediate in like an epistemological sense. Like we know these values, we interact with these values, we have to organize ourselves along the lines of these values every day. Mm-hmm. So once those become undermined, well, if those don't, you know, exist, if those don't have, you know, so, like have a real purpose here, then it doesn't make sense for God to exist, because why would he give us laws that don't make sense? He's a perfectly logical being. How could he do something like that? Mm-hmm. And then that's how, and that this is where the logic leads. And you see that in Protestantism, which also has a political sort of manifestation as well, with, you know, who was it, King? Was it King Henry? Or is it, I'm getting my kings mixed up here, that wanted a divorce from Rome.
I don't know which one, but yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's very interesting because it has a bunch of different sort of layers to it, and you can kind of see how it's kind of a falling away from the actual truth of Christianity.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's basically all the questions I have. This was a great talk. I think we really got into the details with everything, and we did a good job sort of presenting the differences between Guénon's worldview and ours. So, yeah, do you have any final comments you want to make? Anything? Also, if you want to plug anything, you're obviously free to.
Yeah. I think we did a pretty good job tackling all the stuff we wanted to tackle.
Yeah.
You guys could just check me out on my YouTube channel. I'm pretty sure, you know, most people are, I've already been, I think, on your channel before, so people probably already know who I am, but, yeah.
Have you? I don't know if you
have. Wait, or did you come? No.
Yeah.
No, I think you came on mine.
Yeah.
Yeah, my bad. Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, I would just say my final comment would be to join our server. Join the Discord server. And we VC in there a lot now. So if anyone wants to come and talk with us, join the server. And with that, though, thanks for coming on, Gabe. I got to go eat dinner now. But it was great talking to you as always, and
thank you, Ben.
Yeah, well, hey, do you have time to VC tonight, or it's probably late for you? What?
I could probably VC, in a little bit.
We'll get all hard in there, get everyone.
Yeah,
Tommy. Okay, man.
All right,
peace out.
All right,
thanks for
I'll see you. Bye bye.